From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of the nuclear-powered Soviet submarine that ended in a nuclear disaster during the Cold War. We talk with retired U.S. Navy captain and anti-submarine warfare expert Peter Hoogthausen about his book K-19. He's also technical advisor for the new movie based on the story, starring Harrison Ford as the sub's captain. Also, a comic take on the Soviet emigre experience, we talk with Gary Steingart, author of the new novel The Russian Debutante's Handbook. Like his novel's protagonist, Steingart was born in Leningrad. He immigrated to New York with his parents in 1979 when he was a boy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Afghanistan's government denounced a series of American airstrikes that allegedly killed 40 civilians and injured 100 more yesterday morning. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says an investigation of the incident is still going on. Ivan Watson reports from a hospital in Kandahar, where some of the injured have been brought.
Doctors say due to the boy's severe shrapnel wound, there's little chance he will make it through the week. Ghulam is one of 18 patients brought in from three villages in neighboring Uruzgan province. Relatives and eyewitnesses say American bombs hit their homes early Monday morning. Some say they later had to cross checkpoints manned by American and allied Afghan soldiers to bring the victims to the hospital. Standing beside Ghulam's bed, a relative demanded the attackers be punished. Out on the streets of Kandahar, there is anger and outrage at what's being viewed as the massacre of innocent Afghan civilians. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Kandahar.
Swiss air traffic controllers say they warned the pilot of a Russian passenger jet to change altitude just before his plane collided with a cargo jet. 71 people were killed last night when the chartered Russian plane smashed into a Boeing 757 at 35,000 feet over southern Germany. More than 50 of the victims were Russian children who were on their way to a holiday in Spain. Swiss investigators are trying to determine whether the Russian pilot was slow in responding to an order to change altitude or whether the air traffic controller was late in giving the warning. A United Nations Commission report released today warns that the Arab world is suffering from a lack of political freedom, discrimination against women, and poor educational systems. NPR's Kate Seeley reports from Cairo.
Written by leading Arab scholars, the first Arab Human Development Report describes a region of great but largely unrealized potential. It praises Arab countries for gains in literacy and life expectancy, but says that in areas critical to growth and development, the region falls short. According to the report, Arab countries score the lowest in the world in the areas of government accountability, civil liberties, political rights, and media freedom. There are few economic opportunities, and creative output is shrinking. The report's authors say they hope it will spark a dialogue in the Arab world and ignite people's desire for change. The report covers 22 Arab countries with a population of some 280 million people. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Cairo.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index lost 46 points, or 3.2%. It closed at 948, its lowest level since May of 1997. The Dow lost 102 points to close at 9,008 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The head of WorldCom Incorporated called a news conference today to apologize for the accounting scandal at the giant telecommunications company. The company is accused of improperly accounting for nearly $4 billion in expenses. John Sidgemore, WorldCom CEO, said the blame for any wrongdoing belongs to the company's former leaders and its former auditors, Arthur Andersen. Sidgemore said WorldCom will try to stay in operation without seeking bankruptcy protection. American adventurer Steve Fawcett is set to land in Australia after becoming the first person to make a solo balloon flight around the world. Lindsay Arkley reports from Melbourne, Australia.
Fawcett achieved his round-the-world feat during the night, local time, just over 13 and a half days since taking off from southwest Australia. When he officially completed the circumnavigation, he was at a latitude much further south than his takeoff point and flying over sea. Hours after entering the record books, Fawcett was still flying in darkness over water at an altitude of well over 20,000 feet. His support team was working on a plan for him to cross the southwest coast of Australia and land sometime during daylight hours. Weather conditions are good, but a precise location for the landing still isn't known. For NPR News, I'm Lindsay Arkley in Melbourne.
Representative Benjamin Gilman announced today that he won't run for re-election, depriving the GOP of another longtime incumbent. Gilman fell victim to a redistricting plan that would have pitted him against another Republican in the primary. The 79-year-old congressman is the oldest member of the House, winning election to 15 straight terms. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods, on the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In a time when we're worried about the possibility of nuclear terrorism, a new book tells the story of a nearly catastrophic nuclear accident during the Cold War. The K-19 was the Soviet Union's first nuclear-powered submarine to carry nuclear-tipped ballistic missiles, missiles that had the capability of striking the U.S. During its first publicized mission, on July 4, 1961, the sub launched missiles from a test site. On its return, it developed a leak in the nuclear reactor's cooling system. Fire broke out in the compartment containing the reactor, releasing high levels of radiation that killed the men who repaired the leak. Had they failed to repair it, a nuclear explosion would have released a massive cloud of radiation. My guest is retired Navy Captain Peter Hoogthuizen. He served for more than 20 years as an anti-submarine warfare expert. He's the author of the new book, K-19, and was the technical advisor to the movie K-19, which stars Harrison Ford as the sub's captain. It opens July 19th. The book includes excerpts of the captain's journals, including descriptions of what happened after the fire broke out in the compartment containing the reactor. I asked Hoogthuizen to describe the captain's account.
Well, Captain Zataev was an experienced submarine commander, and he knew that it was just a matter of time before he was going to lose control of the reactor, and the reactor would overheat and possibly cause a fuel meltdown and possibly a major hydrogen explosion. So he had a very limited amount of time in which to come up with a solution for rigging a backup cooling system, which was not did not exist. And so as the crew were fighting the fire, he was forced with making a decision whether or not to send crewmen inside the shielded reactor space, which was eventual death, and he knew it, to fabricate a system to provide cooling water inside the reactor.
You know, in the captain's journal, he writes regarding the men who went to fix the system knowing that they wouldn't survive. He writes, "It seems what really determines the choices a man makes in critical, life-threatening situations is still his inner conviction, his sense of responsibility for the events around him, his personal conscience. This is equally true of both the ones who send others to their death and the ones who go." What did you think about reading that?
Well, it shows that Captain Zataev was a very thoughtful man and a very intensive leader who had a great deal of moral integrity. And as any commanding officer who's faced with a decision like that, he made the decision that would have saved, at least the best decision in his opinion, that would have saved his men. But of course that was heavy on his mind, the fact that he was sending individuals in who were certainly going to die. And the sad part of it is that the men who he mentions went in voluntarily, understanding that it was extremely dangerous, probably did not have a full understanding of nuclear power and the radiation poisoning. Unfortunately, we now know in that time in the Soviet Navy, they had rushed those ships and submarines to sea to keep up with the United States and the West, and they didn't properly train them. These were engineers, most of his young engineers, who had been taken from other submarines or from other ships in their navy, given modicum of nuclear power training and then pushed out on a ship with inadequate safety precautions, inadequate casualty control training, and just sent out there to demonstrate that they had a deterrent capability to match the United States. And it was very sad because these men probably didn't understand how serious it was when they each entered to do that welding.
Did the men from the submarine who tried to jury-rig a new cooling system to make up for the one that wasn't working, did the new cooling system work?
Yes, the new cooling system did work. They achieved the surface. They managed to get safely to the surface. And after several attempts, it finally held, and the temperature went down. But they were still faced with a massive amount of radiation on board that had spread from not just the reactor compartment, but throughout the submarine. And he knew that prolonged exposure to this radiation was going to probably kill everybody on board. So he was now faced with getting them home.
Well, home was about 1,500 miles away.
Right. Some of his officers, who had a little bit better understanding of the seriousness of the radiation poisoning, suggested that they take the submarine and beach it at the nearest possible land, which happened to be a Norwegian-owned island, Jan Mayen Island in the North Atlantic, which was housed a NATO ocean surveillance network. His officers came to him with that suggestion, and he opted for another gamble, which was to try to rendezvous with another group of diesel submarines which had been participating in the exercise. But this was a long shot, and he took that gamble, and he actually succeeded in rendezvousing with another submarine who then helped him evacuate the crew to decontaminate some of those who had not been so severely irradiated and actually abandon his K-19 and bring the men to safety.
Let's talk a little bit about the effects of the radiation. The men who were actually in Compartment 6, where the nuclear reactor and the cooling system were, the men who were working to create a new cooling system, they were exposed to massive amounts of radiation. They all died. What kind of deaths did they face?
Well, it was extremely slow and painful. All who died died several days after they got back to home port. So they spent a good 4 days in extremely painful condition. They had been burned internally because they actually ingested a lot of these nucleides, as well as being irradiated through the skin from the by being inside the shielded reactor space. You know, there are different kinds of radiation depending on what your sources are. Some can be shielded just by holding up a piece of paper or by wearing a shirt. Others can be washed off. But if you ingest these into your body, the process becomes extremely fatal. And those ingested nucleides will cause your body organs to swell and be poisoned. They actually bled through the pores of their skin, and their tongues were swollen, and many of them actually eventually suffocated because their mucous membranes all were swollen. It's an awful death.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Captain Peter Hoogthuizen. He's the author of the new book, K-19, which is the true story of a Soviet submarine that had a nuclear disaster on it just about exactly 41 years ago. He's the technical advisor to the new movie K-19, in which Harrison Ford stars as the captain of the ship. And Captain Hoogthuizen served for more than 20 years as a Soviet naval submarine analyst. He was involved in anti-submarine warfare operations. Captain, since you were involved in studying Soviet submarines and trying to prevent them from doing any damage, what were some of the Soviet submarine secrets that you most wanted to find out when you started to have more access to Soviet records after the end of the Cold War?
Well, I think having been involved in anti-submarine warfare most of my career, and then as a submarine analyst in the intelligence business, and then ending up as attaché in Moscow when the Soviet Union was crumbling, and we began to hear the real stories behind what we suspected. I think what I wanted to hear most was what really had happened during these terrible accidents they had. We had a pretty good idea in naval intelligence of some of these accidents, but the Soviets were so good in the control of information that they had managed to cover up for so many years major accidents. For example, the loss of a battleship, 24,000-ton battleship in 1955 that exploded, capsized, and sank in a port in Sevastopol in the Black Sea, and with the loss of 608 men. This was the 20th century's largest peacetime naval accident in history, and they covered it up. The only people who knew anything about it were those who survived and their families. And this was not released into the world until 33 years later, when the former commander-in-chief of the Soviet Navy died. I was in Moscow then in the U.S. Embassy, and we began to hear these stories from survivors who began to step forward and tell their stories. And the same was about the submarine accidents. We had a pretty good idea that they had lost a number of submarines, but we didn't know how many men had been lost. And now we know that during the Cold War, they lost a total of 8 submarines. And that's incredible. And the number of men lost was huge. We had an inkling. We knew where some of those were, but we didn't know the real cost, and we didn't know the real causes. And I had experiences in Moscow, which you wouldn't believe, where people were coming out of the woodwork asking me if I would take this information and report it, because it told the truth about the large number of people that were lost during the race to keep up with us in the Cold War.
Do you think there's a lot of radioactive waste at the bottom of the sea as a result of these nuclear submarine disasters?
Well, there's a lot more than we wish to know about, and it's all come forward, and the Russians have not been terribly cooperative. Right after the Soviet Union fell in 1991, the Russian Federation government was under a great deal of pressure, specifically from the Scandinavian countries, those countries and Japan, where they have a large amounts of this nuclear waste was dumped during the Cold War. And even though the Soviet Union was a signatory to the Prohibition Treaty against dumping nuclear waste at sea, they were doing it secretly and at night and not logging it. And there are bits and pieces of submarine reactors and submarine power plants dumped up in the Novaya Zemlya area and in the Sea of Japan, which is very frightening. Then President Boris Yeltsin, under extreme pressure, conducted a survey in which he had experts go out and try to log this material to see what was really on the bottom. But in that report that came out in 1993, called the short name was the Yablokov Report, they admitted how many reactors were dumped. But since that time, the Russians have clammed up again, and they have prevented international organizations such as Greenpeace and the European organizations from going up and investigating where some of this material was dumped. The frightening thing is, for example, out where the K-219, the Yankee-class submarine that sank in 1986 out in mid-Atlantic, not far from Bermuda, there were 44 nuclear weapons aboard that submarine when she went down. And although it's in very deep water, more than 3 miles deep, nuclear weapons have plutonium in them. And they all disintegrated and exploded as they sank, and that plutonium is scattered on the sea bottom. And although some people, the U.S. Navy specifically, who's very parochial about the dangers of nuclear radiation in the sea bottom, naturally because they get weak knees when you talk about denuclearizing the oceans, because our entire submarine fleet is all nuclear powered. They say the best place for a broken reactor or spilled plutonium is at the bottom, and the deeper the better. However, the smart people from Woods Hole, for example, the people that go down and sample in depths like this, will tell you that we don't know enough about the ocean currents at 3 miles deep to tell you whether or not this stuff can move and whether or not it might get in the food chain, which would be disastrous, because the half-life from plutonium is roughly 200,000 years. You know, that's forever.
My guest is retired Navy Captain Peter Hochthausen, author of the new book K-19. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is retired Navy Captain Peter Hoechthausen. He worked as an anti-submarine warfare expert during the Cold War. His new book, K-19, tells the story of a nuclear accident in 1961 on a nuclear-powered Soviet submarine. Now, I want to ask you a little bit about your experiences in anti-Soviet submarine work. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, you were on an American destroyer that was, I guess, part of the blockade. And what was your mission?
Well, I was a brand-new ensign on a destroyer that was out of Newport, Rhode Island. We were sent out to participate in the blockade to stop the Soviets from sending any more missiles into Cuba. We did not know at the time that the part of the secret plan by Khrushchev was to not only put missiles ashore in Cuba, but to home port a total of 7 ballistic missile submarines in a port called Mariel, Cuba. And we've just found this out recently from newly released information from the Soviets, and that's my next book that comes out in August. It's called October Fury, and it's a story of how we encountered those 4 of those initial submarines, 4 out of the group, the squadron that was going to be home ported in Mariel, Cuba, and we forced 3 of them to the surface. We found the Russian commanding officers, and we interviewed them, and it's quite a good story because we just found out that they had nuclear tip torpedoes aboard, which we didn't know at the time, and that we came very, very close to shooting war with them during that time.
So how did you force the nuclear submarine to surface?
Well, we were following them using our sonar and our passive acoustic arrays, and these were diesel submarines because Soviet nuclear submarines were having such engineering problems at the time, and this was 1962. Most of them were unable to operate in the Atlantic for extended periods of time, so the initial submarines that Soviets had to send were diesel-powered long-range attack submarines of the Foxtrot class, and we picked up the contact, and we stayed with them, in our case, for 17 hours, and we forced them just by good ASW. We knew where they were, we knew what they smelled like, and what their captains were thinking, and we forced them to surface.
And when you got them to the surface, then what?
Well, we had sent out an international warning to mariners saying that any unidentified submarines should surface on an easterly heading, and if you didn't do so, they would be subject to attack. But the Kennedy administration had just gotten an agreement with Premier Khrushchev that in turn for not invading Cuba, but you probably know the full story, that they would then withdraw their missiles. And, of course, this anti-submarine warfare game was going on during all this, and even though we had reached agreement that the Soviets would remove their missiles and we wouldn't invade, we out there chasing the submarines were faced with the commanding officers of submarines who thought we were already at war. They did not know. They were getting no information, we now know, and that when they surfaced, they had to surface, and they were prepared to fire because they thought we were going to try to sink them. And it was a pretty hairy situation at the last minute there, but happily, the personal integrity of the commanding officers on both sides involved, any one of which could have started the Third World War, was so superior that they used caution and nobody shot at anybody else.
So is this further evidence that we came closer to a nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis than we may have thought?
I think we know that we were closer now than we ever thought, because former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, in a news announcement just last year, when he was asked by the member of the press whether or not he knew at the time that those Soviet submarines that we had contact at the time had nuclear weapons aboard, he said no. It was the first time he heard of it.
Well, you've not only served in the American military yourself, your father was a chaplain in the military. I'm wondering if you watched him go through a lot of difficult emotional and spiritual crisis with the men who he ministered to.
Oh yes, I can remember well. My dad served in the war in the Pacific. He was in an infantry regiment and he fought the Japanese in New Guinea and the Philippines. He took part in the invasion of Lingayen Gulf and the liberation of Manila, and then he served in Korea. And I can remember as a young boy and moving around with our family how intensely close to the troops, my father was, having served in combat with them. And he had his unit, which was the 1st Infantry Regiment, one of the oldest regiments in U.S. history, suffered considerable casualties during that fighting. And my dad was always, we often talked to me about the possibilities of becoming an officer, and he said to me that even if you're not a member of the clergy, as a commanding officer, or commanding men in combat, you probably have the greatest moral obligation to proper leadership than you would in as a chaplain ministering to the troops.
What was the most difficult moral decision you had to make while you were a captain in the Navy?
Well, I think my most difficult moral decision was not when I was a captain, but when I was a young lieutenant in Vietnam. I commanded 10 river patrol boats in the Mekong Delta, and when I had to send to men out into combat and faced with the prospect of losing men who I commanded, and I did. I had lost 10% of my men during the Tet Offensive. I think the biggest thing you faced was the fear that you would not make the right decision as a commander in the heat of combat, and as a result, you would lose men as a result of your weakness or failure to do the right thing. I think that was the hardest aspect about being a commander, although I was a young 26-year-old lieutenant.
Captain Hochthausen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure. It was my pleasure.
Retired Navy Captain Peter Hochthausen is the author of the new book, K-19. He's the technical advisor for the movie based on the story, also called K-19, starring Harrison Ford as the captain of the submarine. It opens July 19th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the state of Vermont, connecting summer travelers with the mountains, lakes, and historic villages of rural Vermont. Online travel planning at VermontVacation.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a comic take on life as a Soviet émigré. We talk with Gary Steingart, author of the new novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. Steingart was born in Leningrad and immigrated to New York with his family in 1979 when he was a boy. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The immigrant's immigrant, the expatriate's expatriate, the enduring victim of every practical joke the late 20th century had to offer, and an unlikely hero for our times. That's how Gary Steingart describes the protagonist of his new novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. It's based on Steingart's experiences as a Jewish Soviet émigré who spent the first 7 years of his life in Leningrad, then moved to New York with his family in 1979. The novel focuses on the absurdities of life in the Soviet Union, the U.S., and post-communist Eastern Europe. The novel opens in 1993 when the main character, Vladimir Gershkin, is 25, frustrated with his job at the Emma Lazarus Immigrant Absorption Society, and bored with his girlfriend and her torn black shirts and gothic bracelets and crucifixes. Never having fit into the U.S., after the Cold War, Gershkin leaves for Prava, a fictional city in Eastern Europe, which is attracting lots of young Americans. Let's start with a reading.
In this part of the book, Vladimir Gershkin, who is a kind of malfunctioning immigrant, ends up in Eastern Europe, and he has developed a sort of cultural Ponzi scheme with which he wishes to defraud and get money from the many Americans who have settled in this very hip city in Eastern Europe called Prava. And at this point, he's selling this cultural Ponzi scheme to the Russian mafia, whom he has befriended and who he's working for, and which the mafia is led by a gentleman named the Groundhog. So now Vladimir is speaking. How do we get the Americans to invest in the first place? Here is the answer: self-esteem. Most of these young men and women are trying desperately to justify their presence in Prava and the interruption of their education, their careers, and so on. We make them feel like they're taking part in the resurgence of Eastern Europe. There's an American saying spoken by a famous black man: if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. This saying has deep resonance in the American psyche, particularly among the liberal kind of American the city attracts. Now we've got them not only becoming part of the solution, but making money in the process. Or so they'll think. "Wait 1 minute," the groundhog said. "We don't know any Americans." "That, friends," Vladimir said, "is why I'm here with you today. I propose that I single-handedly infiltrate the American community in Prava. Despite my fluent Russian and my tolerance of drink, I can easily double as a first-rate American. My credentials are impeccable. I have attended one of the premier liberal-minded colleges in the States and have a profound appreciation for the dress, manners, and outlook of the disaffected young American set. I have lived many years in New York, the capital of the disaffected movement, have had many angry, disenfranchised friends of the artistic persuasion, and have just completed a romantic liaison with a woman who in both looks and temperament personifies the vanguard of this unique social group. Gentlemen, with no intention of conceit, I assure you, I am the best there is. And that's that."
Gary Steingart, would you describe the Ponzi scheme that your character comes up with?
Well, it's a very complicated Ponzi scheme. Basically, there's these Americans running around who have no business being in Eastern Europe, but who have come, the way many Americans came to Prague in the early 1990s, to make a go of it, to try, at one point I call it the five-year plan of alcoholic self-discovery. So Vladimir, being both... being a Russian, but one who has lived in America for a lot of a large portion of his life, wishes to defraud them through launching, for instance, a literary magazine called Cagliostro, which is the name of a Sicilian charlatan, I believe, in the Middle Ages, and through other kinds of literary and cultural conceits. It's a sort of a cultural Ponzi scheme, which is a term that came to me after... In the course of one's life in New York, one goes to many, one has to support one's friends, and one goes to these bizarre performances and, you know, mime and acrobatic acts, and then your friends go to your performances. So it's sort of this pyramid scheme where everybody supports everybody, but in the end, the amount of actual raw talent is quite small.
Now, this Ponzi scheme is designed to play on Americans' shaky self-esteem. Why did you focus on self-esteem?
Well, because despite being the citizens of a global superpower, many Americans feel themselves culturally inferior to Europe. And I think this may have to do with the fact that America is at the helm of popular culture throughout the world, which is often seen by others as being, well, offensive, for instance. I was last year I traveled all over the former Soviet Union, and here is... a culture is sort of in the making because the whole socialist template has fallen to the wayside. And what has come in its place are is American popular culture. For instance, I was in Georgia, and there was a gentleman with an accordion who sings Britney Spears songs. You know, he has a very kind of old-fashioned voice, and he sings, "Oops, I did it once more, pum, 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 pum," to an accordion beat. It's really funny and kind of sweet, but at the same time a little scary. And I think that that's what many Americans are afraid of, that they are doing this to the planet at large. Understandable.
About being an immigrant, you've said, getting out of Russia was certainly no panacea. We brought the Soviet Union with us wherever we went. What do you mean?
Well, it's inescapable. I mean, let's look at it this way. Jews and Russians are some of the most anxiety-ridden, oppressed, and maligned people in the past two centuries. And when you put them together, Jewish and Russian, Russian Jews, it's the making of a mental health crisis. You know, this is, we've been through so much in the past century, and there's no way that you can simply move, you know, you get off the plane at Kennedy Airport, and all of a sudden you are a different person, a person free of these, the madness and fears of these Eastern countries, and all of a sudden you become a happy American. It just doesn't work that way. And I think a lot of people miss that because even if you're driving your Volvo and you have your Oberlin T-shirt on, you certainly are not the same as a native-born person who has these accoutrements. So it's there's no way one can shake off history. History follows us wherever we go, I think. And if I ever breed, if I ever have children, I would wonder even if they would have through my... through having me as a father, whether they would have some of the echoes of this terrible, terrible background from which we come from.
Your family left the Soviet Union when Brezhnev allowed Jewish families to emigrate. Did you practice Judaism in the Soviet Union, and did that change when you moved to the States?
I didn't practice Judaism. I practiced socialism in the Soviet Union.
Right.
As a small child, I was in love with the Communist Party, with the Red Army especially, and Lenin. You know, I can still remember songs. Lenin всегда живой, Lenin всегда с тобой. It means, Lenin, he is always alive. Lenin, he is always with you. And as a child, I was very sick, a typical, you know, Proustian kind of sickness, sick child syndrome. And I would listen to these songs and read these books, and I would feel as if Lenin was almost my big buddy, you know. And I would open the window, and there his bald head would be staring back at me. There was one of the biggest statues of Lenin was right outside where we lived. So I was in love with the Soviet Union. And then we came to the first stop for Soviet Jews was, well, it was Vienna and then Rome. And in Rome, I was 7 years old, and my father told me that, you know, it was all lies. None of this was real. And I remember it was the first act, the first instance of heartbreak in my life. I couldn't believe it. I used to play with these clothespins that I imagined were Aeroflot planes. Tupolev is the name of the make. And then I remember switching to Boeing and the Concorde, and that was sort of my first change of heart. And then when we got to America, I was sent to Hebrew school, and we gave Judaism a go. And it was terrifying. The kids would, this was the war in Afghanistan, it was just starting up, and Russians were highly unpopular. You know, remember the movie The Day After and everything like this. So we were the enemy, and the kids would taunt me and make fun of me mercilessly, and I also had this very thick bear coat, and they would call me the stinky Russian bear, much as they do Vladimir Gershkin, the protagonist in the novel. So, you know, so I tried Judaism as much as I could, but that didn't really pan out. So I ended up in Stuyvesant High School, which is one of the math and science high schools, and it's sort of a holding pen for nerds in New York. And there, at this point, I was giving capitalism a go. With all my heart, I wanted to be a capitalist. We had watched Dallas religiously, my mother and I, speaking of religion. JR was a god of sorts. So I tried that for a long time. I really wanted to make money. And I remember in sophomore year, this is so embarrassing to say, I worked for the George Bush campaign. I was a volunteer. And I sat with all these women in these huge fur coats, and me, you know, and a small Russian immigrant, sitting there making cold calls, getting people to vote for Bush. But that wasn't panning out either. So Zelig-like, I decided to take on a fourth identity after a loyal Soviet citizen, Jew, capitalist. At this point, I decided to become a hippie liberal. And this led me straight to Oberlin College. And at Oberlin, I was very much welcomed by... I was a political science major, and I remember there was a visiting professor who would translate Brezhnev's works into Yiddish. You know, this was the sort of thing that went on there. And there, the comrades welcomed me with open arms, too. I wrote a wonderful thesis called Back in the USSR, where it was almost apologizing for Lenin's, the way he had treated, the way he had brought the various nationalities into the fold of the Soviet Union. So basically, after all these different manifestations, the real question was sort of, who am I? You know, who is this Gary Steingart? Which one of these, you know, to put it into a Queen's accent? And I didn't know. And it was about this time that I began writing the Russian Debutante's Handbook. And my alter ego, Vladimir Gershkin, this is when I decided to use him almost as a vehicle for exploring this question.
My guest is Gary Steingart, author of the new novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gary Steingart. He's the author of the new comic novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. It's based on his experiences as a Russian emigre. He was born in Leningrad and immigrated to New York with his family at the age of 7. Let me get back to your childhood. When Lenin was your hero and you sang songs about him and...
And wrote about him,
And
too.
Wrote about him. I mean, this is just what they wanted, isn't it? To get, like, young, smart minds like yours and convince them that... Lenin was an idol, a hero, somebody to be sung about and written about and
sure.
and idolized in every way.
Yeah, in some ways, the Soviet Union made children of us all. You know, I think no matter what your age is, the idea was sort of to put you in this childhood state of mind and to worship a father figure or father figures, the Politburo, if you will, which never really worked except under Stalin when there was really no choice. But yes, this is exactly the sort of thing that they wanted. And they were, it's not like there was much of an alternative. You know, there wasn't Michael Jordan and the way you would worship in the United States. They had a monopoly on thoughts. And for a young child, I mean, I don't know how long this would have continued. I wanted to join the Red Pioneers, but we emigrated before that was possible. The Red Pioneers is the communist youth group for children.
Right. Now you've been exposed to, like, hero worship as Lenin as a child in the Soviet Union. Then you came to the States during the Cold War years when in many political circles, Lenin and anything communist was reviled and was a subject of hatred and fear. Then you went to college where there was a lot of serious intellectual pursuit of the history of socialism. So having gone through all of these different points of view about socialism and communism, did you find it very confusing or did you kind of emerge from that with a point of view of your own?
Well, I think the 29 years that I have lived on this earth have been sort of a grand tour of the failure of these various systems to satisfy their populations. Obviously, America, even under the free market system, does a lot better than socialism certainly ever did under Russia. But one can't turn oneself, one can't simply embrace that as well. One has to be critical. So I think, you know, from Lenin worship to Reagan worship in the space of 5 years, that's quite a jump. So I think I've really seen it all. And my life has been full of these strange juxtapositions. I remember my parents came to visit me in Oberlin College. You know, and these are people who have a slightly jaundiced view of socialism. And they were sort of walking through Oberlin. And there were all these signs, the Democratic Socialists of America welcome you to their socialist powwow. I remember at one point my father was walking through the central square in Oberlin. It's the strangest juxtaposition. I'll never forget it. He's walking across the square, and somebody has drawn a giant vagina on the square. And it says beneath it, "Mom, Dad, you capitalist pigs, here I have tasted my lesbian lover's vagina, and may you capitalist pigs go to hell." And my father is sort of sleepwalking right past it, not saying a thing. Oh, he's talking to the tour guide about, you know, "Please tell me about the rebate for Macintosh laptop computer for incoming freshman student." And meanwhile, he's standing, and I'm thinking, "Dad, you know, get off the vagina. You're standing on this giant genital." And that's when it struck me that the story of my life is so inexplicable. All these endless juxtapositions, you know, from the red flag to a meter-high vagina. It was time to get cracking on the book. And at Oberlin is where I started to do so.
Now, how did working on the book help you figure out your life?
Well, in the end, only analysis can really help in this endeavor. Going through Gershkin became a good friend of mine. Gershkin is the protagonist. Vladimir Gershkin became a very good friend of mine. And in fact, one of the reasons I sat on this book for 7 years, you know, I didn't send it out. I didn't think it would go anywhere, is because it was hard to let him go. He was like a girlfriend you don't want to break up with, even though the time has come. He was an alter ego. And also, I could put him through things I would never put myself through, although in some ways my experience echoes his. Sometimes it's almost 100% the symmetry. But I could look at him, I could look at the way he reacted to the people around him, and I could draw lessons about my own life. And I could try to change my own life, ultimately, which is what I did. The creation of Steingart as a viable persona began, I think, when I started seeing an analyst. And this is when I began to realize that one of the major problems we've had in the Soviet Union was the lack of mental health treatment. You know, in Russia, you saw a psychiatrist, you were sent to a psychiatric hospital for writing something like the Russian Debutante's Handbook. But mental health care, per se, did not really exist. The vodka bottle was what you turned to for solace. And then I was working for this wonderful agency called the Educational Alliance. It's a settlement house. And they had this program, I don't know if they still have it, called Project Help. And it was a substance abuse treatment for Russian immigrants, but it also had this psychological component. And in interacting with the staff and patients of this program, I started to realize exactly what we had in our hands. And that's when I began to think, you know what we really need? Instead of all these IMF and World Bank programs in the former Soviet Union, we need to send a plane load of nice New York social workers into Russia in the former Soviet republics. And this would be the best use of World Bank money. Because without forget the infrastructure and the banking system for a while, we have to start at ground zero, in a sense. And that is to work in terms of psychology with the people who have been left behind.
So it's been helpful to you to undergo psychoanalysis?
Oh, yes, yes, very helpful. It's just...
Did you grow up completely without that concept in the Soviet Union?
Of course, of course. Again, there were psychiatric hospitals, but this was a state weapon.
That was punishment, yeah, right.
It was punishment. Oh, yes, little did I know that it could be such a blessing. Only in Oberlin did I realize that everybody had an analyst in Oberlin, and, you know, people would give me nice recommendations, and eventually I found a wonderful analyst in New York.
There's a part in your novel where Vladimir, the main character, wonders if the fall of the Berlin Wall has made him somehow more timely in the way that people regard him in the United States. Did you go through that, too, that's thinking somehow like being a Russian-American was almost more fashionable at about that time?
Well, one of my favorite lines of Vladimir Gershkin, he says, you know, it is better to be patronized than to be ignored. Yes, I did discover that being a small furry immigrant had its cachet, and that I could parlay that. In Oberlin, it was wonderful, because I did feel so ignored for a large part of my life. I didn't fit into any social structure that I can imagine. But all of a sudden, being disenfranchised, as I said during the reading, being disenfranchised was a positive thing in Oberlin. And being an immigrant was a positive thing, too, and I could work with it. So there was that did happen to me. And in the end, you don't feel any better simply because people are interested in you because you don't fit in. This is not what one wishes to achieve, of course. But it was an interesting, anthropologically speaking, it was an interesting experience, and it was something that definitely informed my work.
My guest is Gary Steingart, author of the new novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest, Gary Steingart, is the author of the new comic novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. It's based on his experiences as a Russian emigre. He was born in Leningrad and immigrated to New York with his family in 1979 at the age of 7. You've lived in the United States since the age of 7. In what ways do you still feel very Russian?
You know, people ask me, where do you feel better when you're in Russia or when you're in America? Of course, the answer is in America. Russia is such a depressing country and will be in the foreseeable future. Sometimes I feel that I feel best when I'm on an airplane between continents and I'm surrounded by foreign nationals, and this almost feels natural to me, this constant state of movement, of migration. I don't want to bring up the stereotype of the wandering Jew. I hope I can live beyond that. But on the other hand, it does happen to some extent. In this country, I have never fully assimilated into this country. I can speak the language fairly well. But especially, you know, I used to have a girlfriend from North Carolina, and I would go visit North Carolina. And, of course, I went to college in Ohio. And people, you know, as soon as I opened my mouth, there would be this amazing gap. It seemed that our experiences were so different that I even tried to adopt a southern twang for a while. I said things like, shoo, doggy, you know. but it didn't work. Nobody believed me. Only in New York, when I touch down in New York on an airplane, do I feel like I'm on solid ground. Because here, everybody's from somewhere else, and it really doesn't matter where you're from. So New York feels like home to me to some extent.
Are there any
more so than the country?
Are there any souvenirs that you've kept from your Soviet childhood?
My walls are festooned with these giant posters. I actually got them after I came, but there are these giant posters, and one is of this. It was called the All Voluntary Union of the Army, Air Force, and Fleet. It wasn't very voluntary, of course, but it was the scheme to get children to give up their lunch money to the the Air Force. And it was this huge poster with a Yuri Gagarin type fella, and he's holding on to his space helmet in this almost oil-like gesture. And it says in big letters, big Cyrillic letters, it says, "Learn to defend the motherland." So I wake up every day, and before I get to work, I see Yuri Gagarin, and I feel something's been lost, something's been gained, and I get to work. And some other hilarious propaganda posters. One is, this would be kitsch, I think, anywhere else, but there's this black fist holding up an AK-47, and it says, "The battle continues, Angola will win," and it's a... it's a poster for the Angolan communist government, and you see the Angola, the communist star, and their symbol, which is, I think, the machete. I mean, what's scary about all this, you know, I idolized Lenin. Lenin was a mass murderer. I mean, the myth of the benevolent Lenin has been thrown onto the ash heap of history. I mean, what kind of a childhood are we talking about when your older buddy is a mass murderer? So it really gives you something to think about. If not right about.
You not only left the world that you grew up in, but that world doesn't exist anymore. The Soviet Union doesn't exist. Your city of Leningrad is now St. Petersburg again. You've been back there. How does it look different and feel different than it did when you were a child?
It looks awful. Moscow has become sort of a more westernized city, but Leningrad, or St. Petersburg, if you will, is still falling apart at the seams. All the money is parked in Moscow. So all these things that... the trams sort of ran on time back then, and all the infrastructure has frayed, and there are certain streets, the main street, Nevsky Prospekt, looks very Western, is filled with Benetton stores and whatnot. But for the most part, it looks decrepit, and the people look like they've been through a war. You know, often it feels that the Cold War did have a winner and a loser, and we lost the Cold War. The Russian people lost the Cold War, and they look like it. You ride around and you see some grandma standing on the sidewalk and selling a sock. One sock, not two, mind you. One sock. And this is not how we grew up. It was a poor country by Western standards, but there was something like a middle class. And you knew that if you wanted health care and an education at some level, you could expect that. Jews faced anti-Semitism, and there were other barriers. But for the most part, you knew you weren't going to, that the world wasn't going to fall away beneath your feet, which it has for the 250 million people or even more that live in the former Soviet Union. The mortality rate is through the roof. Russia will have a population of 140 million, I think, in a year or so. And I think in the next century, it may fall to 100 million. The average life expectancy of the Russian male is 55 years. So it's a terrifying place. And it wasn't exactly so when I left it. It was a place that lived, that was based on lies, built on lies. But in terms of the way people lived, most people expected a brighter future than they do at the present.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Gary Steingart's new novel is called The Russian Debutante's Handbook. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We have some great musical programs coming up this week. Tomorrow we talk with the producers of a new box set of Frank Sinatra's Hollywood recordings. Thursday we listen to rare Louis Armstrong tapes and talk with the director of the Armstrong House and Archives. And Friday we remember Rosemary Clooney with a 1997 concert and interview. She died Saturday. We'll close with a recording from 1990.
First daffodils and long excited cables and candle lights on little corner tables, and still my heart has wings. These foolish things remind me of you. The park at evening when the bell has sounded, the Île-de-France with all the gulls around it, the beauty that is spring's. These foolish things remind me of you. How strange, how sweet to find you still. These things are dear to me. They seem to bring you near to me. The scent of smoldering leaves, the wail of steamers, to lovers on the street.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Saving Your Brain, the revolutionary plan to boost brain power, improve memory, and protect yourself against aging and Alzheimer's by Jeff Victoroff, M.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You see a pair of laughing eyes.
On the next Fresh Air, Frank Sinatra in Hollywood. We talk with the producers of a new box set that collects Sinatra's movie recordings. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Then snap. Those eyes, those sighs, they're part of the tender.